amazing to see people not just talk about the photos, but talk about the message behind the photos, talk about the importance of really acknowledging women of color in the healthcare space and in our culture and the challenges that all of those things may create when we are being treated, and to have the conversations around disparities and what can be done to change those disparities.
My mom has stage 4 cancer in her bones and in her breast. My dad's disease was 15 years, he died of ALS. I made a podcast about death, seemed like the thing to do. And if you're sad by all of this, well, you're gonna die too. Happy week to you all. Hope you're finding a little bit of peace, joy, and or comedy in the grief and dark things that you are experiencing. Wanted to quickly mention that I have been on a lot of one-on-one calls with young people these past few weeks, specifically about loss. I spoke with one person who is anticipating the loss of her mother via cancer. Another friend lost their grandparent to cancer. I know another person whose family member died by suicide. I've been having a lot of one-on-one calls, and I also spoke with someone who is dating someone whose parent died many years ago, and the anniversary is coming up, and they wanted to know how to approach that conversation, which gave me a lot of thoughts. So I'm going to do a solo episode about that shortly. But just wanted to say, if someone in your life is dying, or the idea of death, dying, or diagnosis has entered your life recently, there are a lot of people just like you who are feeling the very same thing. As always, do feel that you can reach out to me on Instagram at dyingoflaughterpodcast or via my email dyingoflaughterpodcast@gmail.com if you'd like to share your story surrounding grief, if you'd like to share your story surrounding anticipatory grief, if you're like, hey, I have no idea what I'm going to say, I don't even know if I want advice or thoughts, I just wanted to tell someone something, hit me up. I got you. Very, very excited to continue this conversation about the pursuit of breast health equity. Oh my goodness. I am so grateful for Jasmine and Marissa. We are talking with the founders of For the Breast of Us. For the Breast of Us is dedicated to empowering women of color affected by breast cancer through education, advocacy, and community. They are all about the pursuit of breast health equity. I first heard them speak during the pandemic on Zoom. I was completely blown away. These two women are paving the way in the community, specifically empowering women of color to connect with other people of color who are currently combating breast cancer, who have survived breast cancer, who have pre-vived breast cancer, et cetera, et cetera. We had part one last week where they delved into their personal stories and talked about how they were diagnosed with stage 1 breast cancer at the age of 26 and with stage 2 high-grade invasive ductal sarcoma at age 35. Now, the continuation of this conversation is really, really important. We are talking about, like I mentioned, breast health equity, specifically the disparity among different individuals and how breast cancer affects people differently. I encourage you to go to their Instagram immediately at For the Breast of Us. You can see them featured on their very first magazine cover just a few weeks ago. The image is extremely powerful. And yet, as we know, images are not alone going to solve any of these things. And yet they do spearhead conversations that can get us listening and talking. So again, go to their Instagram, see their campaign for Black Girls Rock featuring us and their baddies community to make sure that they are seen. I will be doing some shows in Florida the first weekend of the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th. I don't know many people in Florida, but if you're in the Tampa, Orlando, St. Petersburg area, I will be posting on my Instagram soon as to when and where I'll be doing shows. I can get you some comps or discounts, especially because I don't have a lot of peeps in the area. All right, back to the episode. Thank you again, Jasmine and Marissa, for your time. This is extremely important. Please share this with a friend. And I know you'll find this conversation just as valuable as I did. And now we'll head back to the interview. Some recurring themes I'm noticing, I'm wondering if you could talk more about the bedside manner of your doctors. It sounds like you each had ones that you did not care for and hopefully some that you did. What advice would you have for any healthcare professionals listening as to how they could better talk to their patients? And for patients currently listening, what advice would you have for them to advocate for themselves?
I think like Marissa said this before, like she wasn't necessarily doing exams, but she knew her body. And I think knowing your body is like your best tool. You're going to be your best advocate no matter what anybody else says. Also understanding that doctors are human. And like someone said this the other night on one of our Betty's Talk Back episodes, like it's a practice. It's not perfect. And you have to consider their humanness when you are taking their advice and do your due diligence, make sure you understand that's everything that's happening. I would also say for doctors, you know, you're not supposed to like say, like, if I was your daughter, what would you want me to do? But my mom hit one of my doctors with that, is like, if this was your daughter, what would you want them to do? Like, because we don't know. Like, that's what I mean when I say, like, you kind of go in like thinking or guessing that it's going to be really cut and dry, and this is what you do, and this looks like this, and you do A or you do B. And it really wasn't that way. It was a lot of like, what do you want to do? And not really feeling like you had all the information to know, like, what was quote unquote the best thing? What was the right thing? I remember I got hospitalized for an infection around my expand. I was hospitalized for more than 2 weeks, a little over 2 weeks. I had an infection around that expander, and the antibiotic that they gave me then sent me into kidney failure. And so that's how I spent the next week trying to like not bow out from that. Like, I didn't eat for 2 weeks. I couldn't hold down anything. It was horrible. But I remember in this conversation with the doctor, he had an accent. And there's like metastases and a mastitis. And you know what I mean? So mastitis is more like, that's more like a infection kind of thing. But he wasn't clear. And I was trying to, I was like, are you saying that you see that something has metastasized, or that like, this is just like an infection, swollen something, and this is going to get better or whatever? And he was really abrupt. He wasn't willing to answer my question. So the hospital that I went to, though, is one of the partners of the organization that I work for. And like, it was really some God, there was some God things that happened in this. For one, I was waiting on the results from my failed mammogram to decide whether or not I was going to take this job. And once it came back negative, I went ahead and switched jobs. And I honestly think that was such a blessing, because like, my CEO, like, I could not have imagined going through this experience at the other job. So it sucked to be misdiagnosed, but it really worked out for me in the long term. But my CEO was down there. She was making calls. She's sitting in the hospital with me. And she's like, we need to get another doctor down here, because he's not talking to her in a way that she understands. And this is stressful. And like, we don't have time for this. And so like, there's a humanness I think sometimes doctors forget. This is like, at the bare, I don't even want to say like, talk to someone like you talk to your mom. Everyone likes their mom. Talk to someone that, like, I love mine, but I know they don't work for everybody like that. But talk to your patients like someone you love and you care about. Like, you care about how information lands on them. I could not imagine Marissa, like, the person is saying like, yeah, this is probably cancer. Go over there and have a seat.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Is that how you would want someone you care about to be treated? And like, we know that this is a transactional relationship, but like, honestly, when my plastic surgeon left and decided to do a different type of thing, like, I cried, because it's such a vulnerable, intimate kind of experience that you go on with these doctors. So we totally get that it's transactional and that, you know, you're just doing your job. But at the same time, there has to be, you have to treat people like they're people. Not just like they are a disease and this is how you treat that. Like, you have to acknowledge our humanness.
I love that. That's very well said. I think talking to someone like they were your mom, your daughter, or someone like you said that you love is really good advice. So thank you. I was wondering what advice you would have for either healthcare professionals when it comes to talking to their patients, and or what advice you would have for patients to advocate for themselves.
Well, yeah, for healthcare providers, you know, kind of like what Jasmine was saying, like just noticing that your patients, like there is a human side, whatever you tell them, like they're going to have to take that home, remember that too, whatever their home situation is. Definitely give them all the information. I think one of the prompt questions that you can give to a patient is just like, you know, there's going to be a lot of information. If I give you all this information, will you be able to take this all in now? Or should we reschedule you another appointment when you can have somebody here with you that can, you know, help you understand the information that I'm going to give you? You know, I think asking those questions instead of either one, not giving them the information, or just you know, word vomiting so much information that they can't take it in. I think that helps you realize what people can understand. And sometimes they need more than just one appointment, especially when it comes to being diagnosed with, you know, a disease like breast cancer. Like, there's so much information that you get from your breast surgeon and your oncologist and the different things that they need to do. It's like, you know, maybe we should break these appointments up instead of being, you know, just a 1 hour appointment. Maybe you should have 2 1-hour appointments so we can go over everything and you can understand. So I think for providers, we need to kind of look at it that way. I know that they're also, you know, they have parameters because insurance companies want them to see so many patients and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, I love when you can find you a provider who, whether your appointment's 15 minutes, they're still going to spend 45 minutes to an hour with you. And it's not even just you, like they do that with all of their patients. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why you go see them, right? Because you know that they take the time to listen to you or answer any questions that you may have them and their staff. I would say for patients, I mean, the biggest thing is definitely know your body. I would say for me and Jasmine that we definitely knew that we, you know, knew something was off and wrong. Like, you are your biggest advocate. Nobody's going to know your body more than you are. So if something's off, you definitely have to say something. And if you can't find somebody that's going to listen to you, find somebody else. You know, like in Jasmine's case, like she had the one doctor who wasn't necessarily listening to her, but then she found somebody else. And even though that wasn't their expertise, they were willing to find somebody or get her to the places where she could. Same thing for me. It's like, even with my PCP, you know, it's kind of funny because my PCP, she was actually getting ready to retire. And so I think she was in that lull of just like, let me just get through this so I can go type of thing. And so not necessarily to give her an excuse or place any blame on her, but just, you know, I know where she was at in her life. And I'm glad that I was able to just be like, hey, this isn't going to work for me. So let me go find somebody that's going to listen to me and help push me forward. I think especially as, you know, women of color, we have to demand the type of care that we want to receive and be okay demanding that. Not being afraid of somebody calling us the angry Black woman because that's the type of care that we demand, or just being like, okay, well, that they're my doctors, so they should know the best. It's like, again, you know your body. I can't, you know, Jasmine could tell me that she's having a cough for 3 days and I could just be like, oh girl, just go take you some Claritin, but I'm not the one that's having the cough, so I don't know what that feels like, you know? So just being your own personal advocate and making sure that somebody's there to listen for you.
I love what you said about perhaps asking, is now a good time, or would another appointment be a better time to give this information? I hadn't thought about that before. It's like just the honesty with all of it, or if the doctor knows they don't have a lot of time, even admitting that themselves, or perhaps having it another time. Okay, so I want to talk about your wonderful online community for the Breast of Us. You mentioned that you met at YSC and how you're going to lead the first For the Breast of Us community event with YSC. I would love to hear more about the inception of For the Breast of Us and how through social media you've been able to reach more women of color with breast cancer.
So when we were at the YSC summit, we went to workshop, I think it was called something about representation in breast cancer community. And we thought that it was going to be about like people of color. And it was really more so about like people of color in clinical trials. And there was this dismissiveness about Black women not being present in clinical trials. And when you combine that dismissiveness with the mortality rate, it was really disrespectful when you think about it. Because it felt like, do you not, like, we're dying, do you not care? Like, sometimes I've said in several interviews, like, we've been dying in plain sight. People, they've been allowing us to die, because if white women were dying at the rate that Black women were dying, it would be like an epidemic. Like, we would be doing more. It would be doing more. And we would be trying to figure out how we're missing the mark. We would be trying to figure out what resources were needed. And it's interesting that in this last couple of years, to see those conversations shift, we have definitely been part of that shift in that narrative. And for us, it became not just creating a space for Black women, because Black women are women of color, but women of color is an inclusive term for minority women. There is power in numbers. And there are a lot of spaces where this is like the Asian health community, this is a Latino health community, this is a Black health community. And we were really discouraged by some major players when we were just at the idea of this. Don't do it now. Like, we're going to work on something down the line. And honestly, like, it's 2 years later, Marissa, and those same people have not done anything. Don't really do this. And people tried to discourage us, but we felt strongly like there's a space that's needed for our stories and our experiences. I think For the Rest of Us has evolved more than we ever could have imagined that it would have in the 2 years that we've been online. When we first started, it was really just like, we just want to have a blog to share stories and that kind of thing. And then it became like, and we can do webinars and we can partner with people to do campaigns and we can create these unique experiences for women to gain access to information and Q&As and all these different things. And now we're involved in advocacy and research. So just like I said, my first community that I found was the Young Community, YSC. That was also where I first connected with other young women of color, though there were few. There were enough of them to help us spread the word. Like our YSC baddies were really like the first ones that were like, we want this, we believe in this. And some of them really have been rocking with us hard the last couple of years, continuing to help us evolve. But I definitely don't think that we could have ever imagined the impact For the Breast of Us would have on the breast cancer community, because a lot of them copy, they're waiting for us to do. So they copy our flow and change the way that they share stories. And even with this photo shoot, we know that the other photo shoots are going to be coming now because people are like, oh, why haven't I thought of that? So the way that we've really helped shift the conversation in the breast cancer community, being like only having met in person a handful of times, working remotely from different sides of the state, like we've done an awful lot in the last couple of years, and it's a lot for us to be proud of, I think.
Absolutely. It's extremely important. And it's like makes you scratch your head. Why was this not obviously happening before? Is so bizarre to me. And I think that the fact that you guys joined forces and have made the impact you've had is incredible. For those listening who aren't as familiar, I'm wondering if you could share a few of the things that you've done, let's say in the past year, actually a few of the things that you've done the past 2 years, including the webinars and the photo shoots. Like, are there a few projects in particular you could share in a little bit more detail?
I'll share my favorites and I'll let Marissa show her favorites. So some of my favorite things that we've done is the Accomplice training webinar that we led last year after George Floyd. We really debated back and forth, like, is it our place to teach? And I don't think it's any person of color. It's not the burden to own to teach, but we decided that we were well positioned to lead a conversation in this space about real advocacy and real allyship and not performative allyship. And so I think that's something for us to be very proud of. I definitely think we should do it again and charge people this time.
Absolutely. Such a valuable training. I mean, that was incredible. You should absolutely do it again and charge. Sorry, continue.
Almost 200 people showed up for that call. And we literally put it together in like a couple days.
Amazing.
And we've had the honor of doing that training for other organizations as well, which is pretty awesome. Other things that I'm really proud of, the Naked Truth Project campaign last year and that book that was created for that. And now that book is going to be used in breast and plastic surgeon offices across the United States. So women of color will have opportunity to see like photos and stories from women who look like them and their place they're being treated. And the When You See Us campaign that just dropped, that photo shoot, absolutely, like, recognition in France. There were like French breast cancer organizations were sharing our photos. It really started this big dialogue around the imagery. And not just that, it was amazing to see people not just talk about the photos, but talk about the message behind the photos, talk about the importance of really acknowledging women of color in the healthcare space and in our culture and the challenges that all of those things may create when we are being treated. And to have the conversations around disparities and what can be done to change those disparities. So that was pretty awesome. And then my favorite webinar was probably the Sexy Back webinar, because more so like I waited until I was married to have sex. And I was probably one of those people that were in like the grew up in the purity culture kind of thing, which I definitely think does not provide, also this for me, it did not provide a positive view of sex. It didn't provide a positive view for sexuality and sexual health or any of those things. And breast cancer forced me to get into a space where I was comfortable talking about sex and sexual health, because like things aren't working the way they used to. And I wanted help. I was married and like we were young and, you know, there were all these things. And so the Sexy Back webinar it was fun to be a part of. It was fun to like come, like to engage in that way. Cause one of the things I think about is that like as leaders in this space, if we can't address hard topics, we're going to make it really hard for our community to embrace taking on hard topics. So for me, it was like coming out of shell kind of moment. For the rest of us in general, like it has stretched me in so many ways. But those, I think those are some of my favorite things that we've done. How about you, Marissa?
Can I say all of them?
Yes.
Oh, our retreat. Don't forget our retreat.
Was a retreat. Please tell.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely liked our first BCAM, Breast Cancer Awareness Month campaign, the One Word Project. I just thought that was dope. One, to be our really big first campaign that we had. And then just seeing all the responses from all the women, like one word to them that would signify their breast cancer experience or journey. So I really liked that. Definitely, you know, like the Naked Truth Project, our retreats. The retreat we had, it was just with about 20 of our baddie ambassadors, including Jasmine and I and our assistant. And of course, you know, we had fun, you know, kind of like just a girl's sleepover for the weekend, but we also did work and we did some planning and how we could all help move for the rest of us forward and help propel our mission as ambassadors and helping them just become stronger in some of the work that they're doing with us and just within being breast cancer advocates. So that was really cool. And then we also did the photo shoot when we were there. And, you know, the When You See Us campaign, to me, that is like our top tier campaign at this point. I'm not sure how we can top that, but just.
Oh my gosh, I have ideas. I haven't even told you.
That's amazing.
But just seeing all the pictures and the imagery and seeing how everybody loved them. And I think that they loved them not just because of how beautiful the pictures were, but they just loved them because it's just like, I see somebody who looks like me. And I see somebody who has went through the same thing that I'm getting ready to go through, or they've had the surgery that I've been thinking about. And now I have somebody that not only I can see pictures of them, but somebody that I can connect to this. And maybe they wrote a blog or stories for us and they can go back and look at those stories and be able to compare it to, not necessarily, I don't want to say compare, but they can
have a reference point.
Yeah, to their own experience or their journey. So those would definitely be, I mean, I loved all of them. I love the Sexy Back. I love a lot of the things, you know, that we're doing. And I'm just glad that we have people that are with us who are helping us move forward too.
Absolutely. I like that you said people were engaging just as much with the message behind the pictures as the pictures themselves. You know, something that I think is certainly catch 22 of social media is that it's image driven, which is both beautiful, superficial, bizarre, not worth commenting on, all the things. And I remember when I shared your campaign, even to my stories, how many people reacted to that. And that's also an example of how images can help spark conversations, right? Like for better or worse, it's what's catching the attention. And then the conversation can be had, which is so much more powerful than not having the conversation. So thank you for doing that campaign and going above and beyond and doing webinars and retreats and having those conversations. Marissa, you mentioned earlier, why aren't Black and Brown women being researched as much when you are being diagnosed earlier and with more aggressive kinds of cancer? I wonder, since showing up in these spaces, have you heard answers to those questions?
They're definitely speaking to us. I don't know, Jasmine, if they've actually answered that actual question, but they're definitely speaking to us and coming to us and wanting to get more women of color involved in their research. And even if it's just surveys, whether it's not even just medication research, but their clinical trials, things of that nature. So I don't, Jasmine, you would have to help me because I'm not sure if anybody's actually answered that question. I mean, we've been told myths that we've been dispelling, but I don't think that they've necessarily answered the question.
And we're, because we haven't really gotten those great answers, we're in the process of answering those questions ourselves with our own research project, working with Summer Consulting. We're doing a research project right now on a market research on race culture and the perception of clinical trials. You know, it's so interesting because we had a very like big call recently. And when they talked about the disparities, it felt like a lot of patient blaming. It was like, well, they don't go to clinical trials and they don't do this, and they don't do that. And so when I had the chance and I was like, let's consider the number of Black single mothers. Let's consider the type of jobs that the average Black woman has, salary versus hourly. Let's consider that if she is the primary caretaker and breadwinner in her home, what does it look like for her to be able to take a break from work to go take care of herself? She may not feel like she has the quote unquote luxury to be sick. And so when it gets to clinical trials, you know, we've had some big conversations, and you know, it was interesting. I was telling someone last night, and I said, I feel like sometimes Marissa and I are like good cop, bad cop. like I don't feel like I'm a nice person. I try to be a nice person. But like when it comes to business stuff, it's like really, that doesn't sit well with me. And I got to tell you about it. It was like, Black women don't care about research. And I said, well, considering the studies that have talked about like being the delays, that's what it was. They were talking about the delays and going to the doctor. And it was like, a lot of the studies also say that Black women prioritize survival needs, basic needs, over going to the doctor, a doctor's office. And so when you have a community that is still very much so in need, and it's minority communities in general, Latina communities, Asian communities, that are in need of still basic needs, like research is an afterthought. Like this survey is an afterthought. I have to take care of my kids. I need to take care of my family. As we started diving more into like the Asian culture and really starting to understand like, oh my gosh, just how complex it is. And like looking into the minority myth in Asian culture that like they are the model minority, and how that the model minority myth is actually a detriment to them in the healthcare space because they're less likely to be offered resources. There are all of these different dynamics at play that I think it's really going to take some energy and some thought leadership around for us to redesign the healthcare system. Because, you know, some people say like, you know, it's broken, and unfortunately it's not broken. It's doing what it was designed to do. It was never designed for people of color in general. And so we have to rebuild it. We've been teaching women like how to cheat the system. I think goals is like, how do you rebuild the system? So even with some of the preliminary stuff from our studies, I'm a patient advocate for a Mayo project. I'm a patient advocate for a UF Health project. And I said, like, this is the kind of preliminary research that we have. So now when we're looking at recruitment materials, let's go ahead and answer the questions to things that are stopping women from being part. This is how we take research and we use it to like turn the wheel. And my hope is that once this research is launched, then we will be creating some more best practice recruitment stuff so that we can better engage communities of color. Because, you know, we're bypassed, like we said, being seen, being heard. We should be valued. When you understand, when you value the life of Black women as much as you value the life of white women, that disparity is like, that's where your focus is. So we're still talking about millions of dollars being spent on awareness campaigns in the communities that need, that still need awareness. And like, I hate when people say like enough awareness, just research. No, minority communities very much so still need awareness. We are still navigating myths and conceptions that are killing us. And I'm really hoping that us partnering with other people and the research that we're doing will help change the tide for our communities.
Thank you for saying that. And you've already touched on it. And while we're here, of course, certainly both of you don't speak for the Black community, like you said, but while we're here, I'm wondering, what do you wish that white people knew about your breast cancer experiences specifically? I'm also going to mention that I know Ashkenazi Jewish people are brought up in a lot of breast cancer studies. I am Ashkenazi Jewish, so is my mom. I appreciate that that's addressed. I also find that offensive of when 1 in 8 women will get breast cancer in their lifetime. Why are we not just addressing everyone from the get-go? Because it's so common. So I wondered if there's something you wanted to say to white listeners specifically.
I think one, that's such a big question. Like, is there one thing? There are so many things.
What 100 things should white people know?
I think one of the biggest things I wish white people would understand about the experiences of people of color in this space is that, and it's like, it's so much bigger than even breast cancer. Just because you haven't lived it doesn't invalidate it. I cannot tell you how many people will tell us that we're being racist by having this community. When you look up racism, it talks about having power, and we still don't have that.
Wait, that you guys are being racist?
Racist, mm-hmm. Because we
hear it all the time.
I mean, what's really interesting is that this is the pursuit of health equity. That means that's, we're trying to have outcomes as good as yours. But it is racist for us to create a space that helps women achieve that. That's what we're told. Or that we're all the same and we shouldn't be talking about race. No, we have to. You have to. People that today don't see color, that is the exact opposite of what people want. You need to see color, because if you don't see color, you cannot appreciate the different experiences that people have based on their color. I think it is really hard when you are the default to understand what it's like to be the other. And it takes some serious decentering. And it's not about being guilty about it. It's about acknowledging that there are other people's experiences that are less than yours. And there's nothing that they had to do wrong for that to happen. Because we also get into a lot of blaming, right? So I think that's really it. Just because you didn't live it doesn't invalidate those experiences.
Thank you. That's extremely valuable and appreciated. Marissa, is there something you wanted to add to that?
And I would say just, it's hard to tell people to put yourselves in those shoes if they just don't know it. And like Jasmine said, if they haven't lived it, but maybe just reaching out to other people and wanting to learn about those communities. I think when white people hear about like communities of color, people of color, they always think like it's this whole drab story and I'm just going to hear the same thing over and over again. And it's like, no, you may actually find that you have a lot in common. And then you can kind of see where the stopgap is and how we can both, propel each other forward instead of just wanting to dismiss my concerns or whatever, my lack thereof is. So I would say, just get to know. And, I say, if you're not learning something new every day, then you're just stalled where you're at. Everybody should be learning something. I don't care how small or how big it is, once a day. And, that just helps you grow as a person.
And Google is free. Like, you don't have to seek to, right. I would not go to Black people and say, teach me how to do everything. You can do research on your own, just like we had to do research and really learn about systems and how they work and the disadvantages of, and then we have to, when we learn things, it's really each one teach one. We go to these conferences, we come back and we talk to other women about the things that we learned, because we recognize that it is a privilege to be present.
Beautifully said. I appreciate it. Wanted to address the BRCA gene on the topics that you're speaking of. I'm in a mentorship program called Walk with Sally, based out of Los Angeles, where I mentor a 9-year-old whose mom was diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer. We've been together every week over a year now. Her mom was a single mom from Mexico with the BRCA mutation, unfortunately died a few months after her diagnosis. So I've been mentoring her through now the grief process this year. I think that BRCA, while it only addresses a small portion of breast cancer patients, because there are so many, it is something I like to touch on in these interviews. I wonder your experience with the mutation or what advice you might have for other people listening who wonder if they should get tested and when.
So what's interesting is that, if I'm recalling correctly, the BRCA mutation is thought to be known to be more prevalent in Black women, African-American women. And the number of Black women who will tell you that they are actually offered the test is probably not as high as it should be. The fact that not all insurance even covers the test, because I know mine did not, despite my heavy family presence. And then even so, I did not have the gene. The thing is that When you are diagnosed as like an outlier, I always think it's a great idea to get the test, whether it's really young or whatever the case may be. And especially if it's very strong presence in your family, because the thing is, even if the results are negative, then there are still genes that have not been discovered yet. That's one of the things they told me. It's like, you know, it's likely there's a gene that's very heavy in your family. No one this as young as you are. And there are some women that found out they were BRCA2 like years later after like coming back negative the first time. It's not only something for you to have that information, it's also helpful for your family. Because even though I don't have the gene, I was able to get a letter that recommended early screenings for my younger sister and increased screenings for my mother. And so I definitely recommend that women ask about it, at least ask about it, just to see if it's something that would be beneficial to them.
Thank you for saying that. And thank you for, you know, listening about my mentor story. I just think, you know, in 2021, there's no reason for anyone, much less a young single mom, to die of breast cancer who has the mutation. I think it's pretty absurd that we all don't have universal awareness of these mutations and universal screening for those who want it. I know there's implications of mental health if you don't want to have access to that information, but certainly perhaps entering motherhood or perhaps entering a certain point in your life, making sure that that information is out there. So thank you for sharing that. Marissa, is there anything you wanted to add to that?
I would definitely say, you know, everybody should get genetic testing and find ways how they can get it paid. If there's different resources that they have, definitely check in with their social work team, because there are different genetic mutations. I actually have a genetic mutation that now they are finding actually does predispose women to breast cancer. And I remember when I was diagnosed, I had already known 5 years before I was diagnosed that I had this genetic mutation. And it's just like, if they had known then or did research back then maybe I would have been getting mammograms ahead of time. It doesn't necessarily mean that it would have changed my course, but it's just the fact that now other women who have possibly know that they have this genetic mutation and they're young, like I was, they can start getting mammograms themselves as well. So there's a whole gamut of, you know, genetic mutations that are just now coming out that they're realizing that are even more prevalent than BRCA. And I think it's important for people to know that, not only just for themselves, but, you know, for their children, for their sisters, you know, mothers, aunts, just so everybody can know what their family history is.
And sometimes we get so stuck on just like breast and ovarian, like the notion being breast and ovarian cancer, but like your cancer, your genetic mutation, other genetic mutations, like cancer in general running in your family may be a sign that there is a genetic mutation. So it's important to have that kind of awareness.
Absolutely. And still to this day, even after doing this podcast almost 2 years and, you know, being active and open about my mentor experience in watching a single mom with a genetic mutation not make it, I still have friends being like, wait, so do I have to do that? Or what is that? Like people in their 30s that are still so confused as to what it means. So I'm always an advocate for genetic counselors. They can explain in more depth, but it's unfortunate that we don't have more awareness even in the doctor's office for those referrals. It's getting better, but it seems that, I mean, I still had to bring it up to my own. So
I definitely had that experience the other day. I went to go get a CT. And the lady that was doing my scan, like, she was like, so you're young, like, what are you doing here? And these kinds of questions. And she said, yeah, like her mother, her grandmother and her great grandmother, she has no sisters. I believe all of them had died from breast cancer or had some type of breast issue. And she was like, I've been wanting to get screened, but they've been denying me. And I was like, have you talked to a genetic counselor? Like, I think you need to talk to someone just to see if it would be worth you doing the screening. And she was like, tell me more about this. And she works in the medical field. You know what I mean? So there is a serious lack of awareness, but I think that's because we still silo so much of the breast cancer experience. We have metastatic over here, early stager over here. And we don't talk about genetic mutation. It's more like BRCA. You know, and I don't think we've really, the baddies are pretty good at like mixing and mingling, but in terms of like the awareness doesn't really paint a good picture of what what does your average Latina look like who's diagnosed? What is your average? We've been selling like a one size fits all breast cancer awareness. And I think it's a disservice to all of us, honestly.
Really well said. I'm wondering, I have trouble when I open up about my mom's diagnosis. A lot of people will come to me about their grandmother's diagnosis, right? And I don't necessarily relate to that. I'm so deeply affected and here to support them. And, you know, that's extremely important. And yet I think it's very different because my mom was diagnosed when I was very young. I also am such an advocate for the breast cancer community because of the people in their 20s and 30s who are diagnosed. Not because just because I had a mom who has it, it's because, oh, how horrible, even from what I've seen and how difficult, and yet it impacts even younger people and what that would look like. I wonder what it's like for both of you. I would imagine a lot of people might share stories of their own mothers or grandmothers. How does that make you feel? Do you feel like, oh, they're just trying to relate, it's fine? Is it frustrating? I know YSC does a great job of bringing younger people together for this reason, but I really do wonder what that's like for the both of you, if you care to share.
I think that's a great question because we handle things very differently. You know, Marissa and I did, for one, we didn't really know each other when we decided to go into business. So part of our like working relationship with Growing Pains has been like learning how to work with someone that you don't know, and then like still needing to take time to learn the person like behind that. And for me, as I've gotten further out from treatment, I have wanted less and less to be in like those one-on-one mentor kind of roles. I don't really want to have the conversations about like people just want to tell me that they're being diagnosed. I've tried to start separating things out on my social media even, and more from a mental health perspective, because it was just felt like all cancer all the time. So from the way we work, Marissa does more so of like the community facing stuff, and I try to do more of the back end, like the strategic partnership, that kind of stuff, because it's not, I'm just not. And when I was first diagnosed, it was very important for me to find community, but I think I have that now. I don't want to be in the position where I am constantly starting over with people or being the like emotional dump for like, oh my God, I think it's a lump. And I had someone like come to me one day, and not that I don't think there's value in having someone to do that. That's why I'm facilitating spaces where for you to connect with other women who can get that. But I don't want to be that person. I don't have the desire to be that person. And I'm okay with that. And I think some people, they find those boundaries. Some people can find that a little off-putting, but I got to take care of myself.
Boundaries are so important. I love that you know that about yourself, because then you're able to do a service to others and to yourself by connecting them with someone else. So good for you. I think that's really important.
And I think I'm getting even better with now, like if people, even personally, if they see me and they're like, oh, such and such was like diagnosed or whatever. And I'm just like, oh, okay, well, we have our private Facebook group, you know, send them there. They could connect with somebody there, you know, and just being like, okay, because yeah, it does get to be a lot, you know, even just, you know, on our weekends. And if people are like hitting us up and stuff, I'm just like, okay, so is this an emergency for real? Or can I just like veg out on the couch? Because like, no, like, you know, I think Jasmine and I are doing a good job of that now, of like setting boundaries with people and just being like, we're reclaiming our time. This is our time. Because, you know, besides running for the breast of us, like Jasmine said, we both have full-time jobs, which when we say full-time jobs, like those are dedicated full-time jobs. Like it's always busy, always this. And then you're like thrown right into for the breast of us. And that, of course, is always busy and a lot of stuff going on over there. So being able to find the time to for yourself is definitely important, and just making sure that you do take that time for yourself. I think everybody has to. And I think it's also good for people to come in and out. I think we've noticed that with some of the baddies and some of the people that we've met through YSC, like sometimes they'll come into the space and then they'll leave and take a break and then they'll come back. And I think that's okay for people to do.
Yeah, I know, like I definitely like I've turned off the notifications for a lot of the groups, especially on Facebook. I now have like a separate Instagram account. So like I know if I'm on there, I'm expecting to see breast cancer stuff all the time. I've stopped accepting the Facebook requests from people that I don't really know that our only connection is breast cancer. Someone talked about trauma bonds, and I think that it's like it's such a true thing. Like you're just connected to someone because you've both had this really horrible experience and that's really all you've got. And I do not want that. And I'm recognizing
Yeah.
Especially when you have hundreds of trauma bonds, thousands of trauma bonds, millions of trauma bonds.
And I it, we've had like these instances where people feel like because we're grassroots and now like from a strategic perspective, I'm like trying to do my best to kind of move Marissa and I from out of like the front before the breast cells, put our baddie ambassadors more into the front so that way they can start to like think community, not Jasmine and Marissa. But when it's like really grassroots and you're in you're I'm saying like it's not like we're really big yet. We're gonna be really big. But even in the growth that we've had, people know that they're talking to Jasmine and Marissa in the chat and they start to feel like they're your friends.
Right.
And they start to feel like and feelings have gotten hurt when they're not selected for things. And it's like, this is not what that is. Like we're running a business. And that was one.
Right. It's not
Exactly. It
personal.
was one of the things that I said to like tell Marissa a lot at the beginning. Like we have to remember, like build a relationship with the business, not with you. Like, so like, if they don't need to know it's you behind the keyboard, they need to be responding to the account. They need to love the account. Otherwise people really did. They started to build like these really uncomfortable, really one-sided relationships with us. I think that also can get really stressful.
Well, thank you for your honesty around that. I know there's a lot of young entrepreneurs and people growing their own businesses and accounts who listen to this, and it's inspiring to hear your own boundaries. And last but not least, before I ask where people can find you, we'll hold off on that for just one moment. Just like like a baby answer, because I think it's fun. But what advice do you have for those people who want to get their own message out into the world and grow their own stories and messages and accounts? I know it happens sort of naturally because there's such a wonderful need from this, but because you guys have lived this, have kids, full-time job, it's really inspiring if you have a few words to that.
I would say my biggest thing is just to go for it, man. I tell people all the time, like Marissa is a woman of faith as well. There's nothing big that we've done that's been done apart from God. Some of our most successful campaigns have been ideas. And like, I know my team hates it. My team, like, I text in the middle of the night and be like, so I just got this idea and we're gonna make it happen. And like those, like I call them God ideas, those little sparks, those little whispers. It's like, try this. I like they were like for days I was trying to figure like this is something about C. It needs to have C in it. And I got it in the middle of the night. And the next day I'm in our group and I'm like, ladies, so we're gonna do this campaign in 2 days. And so like go for it. Like those whispers, like you follow that, you follow God's voice. And a lot of it has been not knowing what the next step is going to be. We just take these leaps of faith and be like, well, this sounds like it might work. Let's try it. And these things have turned out like bigger and better than we could have ever imagined. So take the jump, make the leap of faith, go for it. That's my best advice.
I love that. So well said. What do you ladies hope is next for the rest of us in this upcoming year? And where can people connect with you online?
There's going to be a lot, you know. Hopefully, if COVID kind of slows on back down again, we can host another retreat in 2022. You know, definitely going to a couple of conferences, getting the word out about For the Breast of Us, a couple of campaigns. We do have our Breast Cancer Awareness Month campaign coming up. So if you want to promote that, I'm not sure when this is going to go, when you're going to actually have this go live or not, but
First week of
submissions
October,
are.
baby.
Oh, okay. So by then it'll already be,
Oh,
but we
well, maybe we can do it
well,
before in honor of
no.
that.
I
You're like, that is not helpful.
was gonna say
Just kidding.
if people wanted to submit for it, it's due this Saturday. But
Got it.
just to promote it, we will have a campaign in October for Breast Cancer Awareness Month called Breast Wishes. So everybody should tune into that. We'll definitely have some pretty dope stories and words from women in our community. So we have those things coming up. And they, of course, can reach us at breastofus.com. We are at For the Breast of Us on Facebook and Instagram, The Breast of Us on Twitter. And what else am I missing, Jasmine? Am I missing anything?
We will probably be at San Antonio for San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. We may be doing a baddie brunch while we're there, if it's not canceled. And I mean, we're being tapped to do like some really cool like conferences, like Marissa said. And I think probably the conferences, the next retreat, which I hope will be bigger and better. And I don't know, man, we're always trying to go big. Oh, we have some new partnerships coming up, helping women of color get more into mentoring in the breast cancer community, some digital partnerships. Maybe the baddies might be moving to a popular app. So there are some great things coming ahead. We're like growing and thriving and doing the darn thing right now.
Amazing. Well, huge congratulations on what you've both already accomplished in just a couple of years, plus beyond with your own outreach, I'm sure began long before that. Is there anything else that you wish that I had asked you, or do you have any questions for me?
Absolutely not. This has been great. This is a great chat.
Love it. Well, thank you both. Thank you so much.
You have a great night.
Yodo, you only die once.